This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello, in 1786, Robert Burns had a collection of his verse published. It was Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect, and it made him famous. He'd been a struggling tenant farmer on the point of emigration, yet was now celebrated as Caledonia's bard, the heaven-taught ploughman, and his reputation spread around the world. English romantic poets made pilgrimages to his cottage, his songs were sung by revolutionaries in Germany and China, and Auld Lang Syne has become an international anthem at New Year. With me to discuss Robert Burns are Robert Crawford, Professor of Modern Scottish Literature at the University of St Andrews, Fiona Stafford, Professor of English at the University of Oxford, and Murray Pittock, Bradley Professor of English Literature and Pro Vice Principal at the University of Glasgow. Murray Pittock, what was Robert Burns' early life like?
Well, Burns grew up in poverty because his farmer, who is effectively a landscape gardener, had become a farmer and couldn't really make his farms work. And he spent a good deal of his teenage years labouring on his father's farm, being really the source of labour. And then a very dispiriting time in his early 20s when his father's being sued for back rent payments, which almost brought the family to penury. But he did. His father, who was often impressed his contemporaries, especially his contemporaries of higher social rank, tried very hard to give Robert Burns an education, and particularly the influence both in tutoring and at his school of John Murdoch was important. And John Murdoch both taught Burns for a relatively brief time formally, but he remained a contact and in touch with Burns at a later period when Burns was a teenager. And so Burns devoured books at an early age, but he had very few of them. And yet by his early mid-20s is described as having a large library. And en route, he certainly acquired some facility in French. He tried and failed many times to learn Latin. And as my colleague Nigel Leask has recently demonstrated, he actually made a stab at Greek in his later life.
So this is in Ayrshire. Was there land, the land that his father tried to farm, was it particularly difficult land?
It probably was not great land. At any of the farms he did, but I think that it's probably the case that William Burns was not a great farmer, and it's the probably Burness, I should say, and probably the case that Robert was not a particularly great farmer either, because sometimes he chose rather he didn't choose the first farm he saw. That was, he sometimes turned down farms, but he did choose farms that other people might have turned down.
This is as a tenant.
Problem, as a tenant farmer, yeah. Yes.
You mentioned Murdoch. Could you tell us a bit more about him? Who taught him? Yeah. Not every day. He was hired for a little while and so on, but he obviously was an educative influence.
He was. He was a graduate, an educated man, and appears to have had, though I think the detailed documentary evidence is lacking, really very close relationship with Burns. Certainly he crops up a lot in Burns's early life.
He was called heaven-taught ploughman, and much was made of his from the earth, earthy, very almost peasant-like, they'd have said, in what we used to call Europe. How true was that when he was in his, by the time he was in his mid-20s? You mentioned that he'd got a decent-sized library by then.
He always had problems with finance, but they were to some extent structural. When he was getting the subscribers, or rather his friends were getting the subscribers together for the Kilmarnock edition of Poems, his putative father-in-law, Armour, was going to sue him for what he now, since he now thought Burns had a significant amount of money, and Burns put all his family assets into his brother Gilbert's name and keeping, and it was not the last time he supported Gilbert. So in the end, although he had a good salary every year in the 1790s in particular, it was about 40% or 50% more than Jane Austen enjoyed as an annual income in 1805, he nonetheless could only get himself onto a strong financial footing long term by breaking his brother Gilbert, which he absolutely declined to do.
Thank you. Fiona Stafford, locally, before he became known as a poet, he caused a stir over his relationship with several women. What do we know about that?
Well, we know a little bit about what he says himself. So when he is writing an autobiographical letter, he describes how love and poesy began together, and he tells the story about one of the plus sides of being on the farm, I think, was when he was working on the harvest, age 15, and by his side was a very attractive 14-year-old. And he had worked out that in order to perhaps get some tender feelings from his co-worker, he could try a poem or a song. So he makes no secret of that. In fact, he's rather proud of it. But we also know that not much later than that, he had a relationship with Elizabeth Patton, a servant girl. She became pregnant by him, and there was a scandal about that. He had to answer for that in the Kirk. He didn't marry Elizabeth. By the time she had her baby, he was already interested in Jean Armour, who also became pregnant by him quite quickly. He also had a complication with Mary Campbell. We don't know quite what happened there. It's possible she was pregnant as well. So he was one of these obviously very attractive men who didn't get really going for either or if there were plenty of opportunities.
And he had quite a lot of children.
He had quite a lot of children,
Can
yes.
you just fill out that rather prim remark of mine?
Well, Jean Armour, who became his wife, quite a brave woman, she had 9 children.
She did say he should have had 2 wives, didn't he?
She did, yes. I think that was a bit of an understatement, actually. And then he had several other children as well. Elizabeth Patton definitely had a baby. There was a woman in Edinburgh, Jenny Clough, who seems to have had one of his babies, and quite a bit later in Dumfries and Park, had a baby by Robert Burns as well.
And did his wife Jean have 9 children?
Yes.
So he totted up to quite a few. I read from what you've written and from what I've read elsewhere that he tried his best to look after them rather unusually.
Yes, exactly. He did feel concerned about his children, and he did, you know, want to maintain them, but it didn't mean he necessarily wanted to be married to the mother. So maintaining the children didn't necessarily go with making the mother respectable, which at that time was obviously quite complicated.
For one or two of these misdeeds, he was made to do public penance in church. Now, what was his relationship with church, and what form did the public penance take?
He had to go and sit on the cutty stool. The cutty stool, a small stool, and be reprimanded publicly in church, which he did not think much of.
Which church is this? Which one? Which denomination are we talking about? Presbyterian?
Yes, Presbyterian Kirk. And I think he went through that experience, and so did some of his friends as well. And it tended to inspire satire on the Kirk, actually. That's how he reacted to it. So I'm sorry.
After you.
I was going to say a poem like Holy Will is Prayer, which he didn't publish as part of the poems, chiefly in the Scottish dialect, was inspired partly by one of his friends having that experience.
And Holy Will is Prayer. Holy Willie is saying, can you finish all that off?
Well, Holy Willie is supposedly confessing to the Lord and saying his prayers and hoping that he's going to be one of the saved, which he assumes he is, which means that his own little misdemeanours in this direction are obviously going to be forgiven. So Burns is pointing out the hypocrisy of the church elders, really, in that poem. But it's very funny, so it's definitely a satirical poem.
But organised religion was something that he veered away from quite early on and stayed away from, although could he be called religious in any way?
Well, I think he was, and I think it did have an effect. I think he would definitely be seen as moderate in his religion. He didn't agree with the kind of extreme Calvinism at the time, but I don't think that meant he was completely without any religious feeling.
Do we have evidence for that?
I don't think we have hard evidence, but I think in some of his poems you get a sense of it. But I think he's more comfortable writing about the deal than about God.
About the devil and about God. Mm. Yes, he keeps missing out the V.
Yes, he does.
And that's dialect. We're coming to that. Robert Crawford. It was a very difficult existence to be a farmer in the north, anywhere. And so it was punishing physically, and that stayed with him, didn't it? That had an impact in him. How did he manage to go away? And it was exhausting. So how did he get the energy to writing, that obviously flowed through him, but to get published, to enter into all the business of that? How did he get going?
Well, his poems were circulating, I think, both orally and in manuscript before he published his first book. He came not just from a textual culture, but particularly from his mother's side, from an oral culture. She was a great singer of songs. When he writes about her, she's often singing. There was an old relative of his mother's who also lived in the house who had a huge store of folk tales and songs as well. And those fed into the poems that Burns is making in the early 1780s. So they're circulating among friends in manuscript. He gets a reputation as a wit. And then in
reputation where?
Locally, in Ayrshire, in the west of Scotland.
So we're talking about which area? Kilmarnock area?
Round about Ayr, round about the farms that he's living on, which are outside Ayr. Then his first book is published by subscription in Kilmarnock in 1786. In an edition of about 600, half the copies are subscribed for in advance. His family, his friends and himself, they're all gathering subscriptions. Burns is a great networker, not least because he's a Freemason, so he uses Masonic networks as well. The book comes out and it's a hit locally. It's not just a hit locally, but a few copies circulate more widely. The book reaches Edinburgh. Burns, and this is the hardest thing I think for us to deal with in our time, is on the point of emigrating to Jamaica to work on a slave plantation.
Why do you want to do that?
To make money and to get the hell out from Jean Armour's relatives. He's in trouble. He has, as so often in his life, woman trouble. He seems reluctant in some ways to go to Jamaica. He misses the boat several times, and ultimately, instead of sailing to the New World, he rides across Scotland to the New World of Edinburgh, where there's a chance his poems can have another edition. That edition comes out, 3,000 copies now, so about five times the size of the Kilmarnock edition, and it's a big hit. It's a big hit socially. Burns suddenly is the man you want at your party if you're an Edinburgh socialite. So he has made it then.
Is there any way to summarise why that impact was so big at the time?
I think it's bound up with the charisma people felt he had as an individual. Walter Scott, who only met him once, talks about the brightness of his eyes. A lot of people testify to that. You can hear an acoustic equivalent of that brightness in the poetry. It's jaunty, it's lively, it winks. There's a kick of mischief to it. There's a whisper of mischief to it. The very first poem in his first book is called The Twa Dogs, and is, as its title suggests, about two dogs. The subtitle is a tale. Is that a joke? I think it is. And Burns goes on making jokes throughout this book. One of his most famous poems is set in church. It begins with the sound, ha! Exclamation mark, which is a bit like sneezing in church, or maybe more laughing in church. Mm. That's the poem To a Louse. Well, so there's a vein of humour runs right the way through, although the poems may also be about ruin, about despondency, about love. There's tremendous range to them.
Was there a sense of patronage or surprise in the idea that he was a heaven-sent ploughman?
Yes, he was patted on the head a little. Henry Mackenzie, Edinburgh lawyer, who uses that phrase of him, he uses it to encourage him, but also, I think, just a wee bit to talk down to him. Nonetheless, Burns encourages this notion that he is a ploughman poet, a kind of people's poet, a bard, a word he loved.
I would take a slightly different view of the Mackenzie review in The Lounger, which is that Mackenzie uses the term ploughman poet directly after he's made a comparison between Burns and Shakespeare, a comparison which he immediately says he doesn't mean to have made. And then later on he talks about Burns' Woodnotes Wild, which actually Burns uses as a motto on his coat of arms later. But that reference, Woodnotes Wild, is a reference to the depiction of Shakespeare in Milton's L'Allegro, Swedish Shakespeare, Fancy's Child, warbling his native woodnotes wild. L'Allegro was a highly fashionable poem in the late 18th century. What Mackenzie is doing, I think, is actually portraying Burns as an equivalent to the unlettered Nature's Child of Shakespeare and making him for the first time a Scottish equivalent of Shakespeare.
Can we get to the poetry now? Let's start with To the Mouse. There's a big contrast between the first, let us call it, stanza and the second stanza. Now, could you read the first stanza the way he would have read it and it would have been heard then? As a book. Now, who can read it best? There, the first stanza.
Wee slicket cowering timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start away so hasty with bickering brattle. I would be laith to run and chase thee with murdering pattle.
And then it switches to the second verse is Enlightenment English.
It certainly is.
Do you want to do that?
I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earthbound companion and fellow mortal.
So is that a clue, a good clue, to the way he mixes up his different languages? Can I have my book back, please?
It certainly is, but he does it for different thematic reasons. He does, as a much more recent comment would put it, he does the police in different voices. He creates different voicings to create different perspectives, and what he's doing there is that the enlightened voice is a Smithian perspective. Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments is very influential on Burns. But one of the things that Smith argues is that ultimately language will have to be standardized in order for commerce and trade to be international. And what Burns is doing is intensely localizing language so that he actually puts what he's doing in To a Mouse is putting Smithian sympathy in the context of an Ayrshire farmer's perception.
And he's also localising his subject matter. I mean, aren't many poems written to a mouse? And out of it, he gets a line which is quoted at again in the best laid plans of mice and men gang off to glay. And on it goes, Steinbeck takes it up, and it's quoted, I presume, all over the place, all the time. So he brings that out of a close-up of a mouse. He then turns his attention, I don't know the order of this might have been first, to a louse, Fiona Stafford. Now, what does he get out of the louse?
Well, in a way, I think a louse is an even less likely addressee than a mouse. And I think he's very fond of playing on people's conventional expectations and their sense of a creature that is somehow vermin or hideous or undesirable in some way. And the poem begins with playing on that because it's a louse that he's seen on a young lady's bonnet in the church. And I think everybody reading that has a little shudder imagining this louse creeping across your bonnet.
So why is he doing that? I mean, it's a wonderful poem. And again, he gives us a great line. You're going to have to say this.
Would some power the gifty gears to see ourselves as others see us?
That's right, yes. Yeah.
And that's very Adam Smithian. That's a straight
Adam Smith,
Scots
Wealth of Nations at the same time, yeah.
That's a straight Scots versification of a little passage from Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, a book of philosophy that had been published in the year of Burns's birth. So that's a hint as just to how well-read and well-educated Burns is. But it's also a hint as to how easily he can move between English language and what he calls the Scottish dialect.
Fiona.
But I think it's also a joke on himself, because it sounds very authoritative, because it is an allusion to Adam Smith, who's a very kind of dominant moral philosopher at the time. But I think that this is one of the reasons I like Burns so much, is that he's often self-mocking. So the poem appears to be making fun of this young woman who's got her new bonnet, is looking very proud of herself. But actually, as it goes on, you realise that Burns is making fun of himself, because there he is in church and he's much more interested in the lady's bonnet and the lad. So that idea of could you see yourself as other people see you is a joke as much, I think, on the speaker as it is on Jenny.
And it's also a poem of an immensely complicated register, because as well as that end, the English, he uses both southwestern Scottish and northeastern Scottish dialects. So, for example, Flean and Toy. Flean in the northeast is a compound that is used to describe eating and foodstuffs. So this is foodstuff for the louse. But in the southwest, literally it's the flannel cap a woman wears, but it's also slang for the female genitalia. So it's the poem is both about sex and about greed at the one time, depending how you read the two different elements of Scots dialect.
Can we go broader, if we can? I'm slightly broader than a louse and a mouse, Robert Crawford. What is his relationship with the natural world in his poetry? What could we say about that?
Well, he's a farmer poet, and he'll talk to anyone. He'll talk to a lord, he'll talk to a louse. And that sense of switching tone and yet remaining, in a sense, someone who speaks with a democratic voice is absolutely essential to Burns.
Can you give
Burns's
us an example
tone.
Of that? I mean, he has
Burns
a good old cursed lords. And
Burns hymns what he calls the royalty of man. Burns's ideal is the man of independent mind, who looks and laughs at all that. And by all that, in that particular song, he means lords and honours and emblems of hierarchy. They don't matter to Burns. What matters to Burns is the nature of the particular addressee in front of him, be it a louse or a lady or a mouse or a man.
But in terms of the natural world, the rivers of Scotland, he wants to make the rivers of Ayrshire as famous as the Thames.
Yes, so. He wants to sing his locality. And he does love rivers. Flow gently, sweet Afton. He likes wandering up river banks. He likes that kind of scenery of gentle hills and wooded glens that you find in the Ayrshire he grew up in. He also likes Highland scenery.
Yeah.
He likes mountains and snow. And yet only up to a point. People often say Burns grew up, particularly in one of the farms he lived in when he was young, looking right across to the very noble mountains of Arran, which later entranced Wordsworth when Wordsworth visited. Robert Burns never mentions them. He has a farmer's sense of the land, I think, and of the creatures and the land. One of his breakthrough poems is Spoken by a Dying Sheep. He likes different voices. He likes speaking to animals, and sometimes he likes it when the animals speak back. So he has a farmer's sense of nature's social union, rather than simply a kind of touristic gaze, however much later in his life he may go on Highland and Lowland tours.
Fiona.
Just coming in on that point, I think he's quite an unusual farmer, that he is sympathetic to a mouse. That seems to me not the typical farmer's attitude, especially not if he's busy ploughing and he happens to turn over a mouse and her nest. I think, to be honest, quite a lot of farmers would probably just keep going on with the work. So he, I agree with you up to a point, but I think he's quite an unusual farmer in some ways.
That's an absolutely fair point. What he's doing with that mouse, though, is he's using it as an emblem of what we might now call habitat loss, but he's also thinking about the fact that his own family may be put out of their farm. It's a poem written just after one of his brothers has died as a teenager. So although sometimes people might want to think of To a Mouse with its wee Sleekit Cower and Timorous Beastie as almost a Disney-type cute poem, it's actually a poem fearful of ruin and eviction, and it's quite a dark poem.
Yes, and he emphasises with that fear himself, doesn't he? But coming to you, Murray, he wrote songs, a lot of songs. Can you tell us, I know there's so many, can you tell us how, did they come easily to him? Who provided the music? What happened?
Well, Byrne spent most of the latter part of his career, with some big set piece exceptions like Tam o' Shanter, writing or editing songs. So when he's in Edinburgh, he's introduced to James Johnson, who's just about brought out the first volume of the Scots Musical Museum, as it's called, which Burns contributes a couple of songs to, notably Green Grow the Rashes O. And then Burns subsequently co-edits and starts to write prefaces for the next four volumes. And the last one, the sixth volume, appears after Burns dies, which is brought out by Johnson. So we attributed 100 of those songs to Burns, eventually 250, probably 150 to 200 are mostly by Burns. What he does typically is he gets a traditional song and he edits it, sometimes very significantly. He improves it, sometimes very significantly, sometimes to a more limited extent. The tunes are provided by the Episcopalian organist of St. Patrick's Church in the Cowgate, but mostly from early 18th century collections.
Where did Auld Lang Syne and My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose come from?
Well, Auld Lang Syne is 17th century, there are some 16th century elements.
Did he find the words?
He found a large number of the words. It is.
Why say found? You mean they were already written and he took them up?
He took up a significant portion of what we now know as Auld Lang Syne from pre-existing versions, which is one of the reasons it's a poem in the 18th, a song in the 18th century of Jacobite exile, which is why Seas Between Us, Braid Ae Roared, for example, survives in Burns's version. In terms of My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, I think Robert might want a word here, because Robert thinks that poem derives from Burns's relationship with James Hutton, and I think there are more traditional elements again that Burns is picking out there. But what he does is he perfects the elements that he finds, but he's not actually particularly musical. There is a weakness in some of the tunes, and they're sustained by earlier 18th century collections. Burns is not that musical. He can do a little bit, but he can't really edit music beyond
the words. The lines are musical, aren't they? I mean, yeah. My love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June, that dances like a banana, and so on and so forth.
I think he has a great ear, but by all accounts, he wasn't a great singer. So he wasn't formally musical, but he has a poet's ear for language, and that lets him remake songs, so that sometimes it's quite difficult to tell how much of the song pre-existed Burns and how much of it is Burns. You might say, oh, he's a plagiarist then, but actually no, he's able through recasting these songs to fuse his voice with the voice of traditional song. If you think of a song like A Fond Kiss, his famous song of parting, A Fond Kiss and Then We Sever, A Farewell and Then Forever. Now, the earlier version of that song has the verb sever in it, but it's hidden away in the middle of a line. Burns takes it and makes it the end, the rhyme word in the first line, and that sense of severance is therefore intensified. He had a genius for taking earlier material and remaking it with finesse.
Fiona, so he's there in Edinburgh, the toast of the town, a celebrity in his own lifetime with that book out and taken up here, there and everywhere. And is it then that he Is he developing his poetry? Is this when he comes to write Tam O'Shanter, and how important is that?
He writes Tam O'Shanter a little bit later. I think when he's in Edinburgh, he is wanting to expand his edition, but I think he's also rather overcome by the expectation. I think having had such an unexpected massive success, and I think coming from the background that Murray's described, to find himself fated by all the great men of Edinburgh and have, you know, young Walter Scott sort of sitting at his feet at these literary salons, I think actually it was quite overwhelming for him. He writes to one of his friends saying that he feels that the expectation is beyond his powers, and he looks into the future down as he would into a bottomless pit, he writes in one of his letters from Edinburgh. So I think actually, although he's very excited by all the success, there's something quite intimidating about it as well.
So he comes to Tam O'Shanter a bit later, but it'd be useful to pause and have a look at Tam O'Shanter now. So tell us about Tam O'Shanter, please.
Well, Tam O'Shanter, I think, is really interesting because it is rather different in character from the poems that have made him so famous and successful. There's nothing really like Tam O'Shanter in poems, chiefly in the Scottish dialect. So Tam O'Shanter is a witch's tale. It's a fusion of different local folk tales, probably. And it's quite a longish, by Burns' standards, narrative poem. He writes it in rhyming tetrameter couplets, and it runs on and on, and it has this sort of jaunty, gallopy atmosphere.
Gallop because he's on a horse. He's got drunk in a pub with pals, and on a dark night left his wife at home.
That night,
drunk, goes out on the horse and comes across a witch's coven, and he's very excited because he likes the look of the witches. Then they turn on him.
That's it, in a nutshell.
And he flees.
Yeah, he says it at much greater length, but that is absolutely what happens.
So what was the strength of it? Why did it take on?
Well, I think partly because it's so funny, partly because it is so well written and well composed, partly because I think people just get drawn into it, and it is very unclear, because he is so drunk, exactly what he's seeing. And I think that the whole kind of idea of riding home on your own in a terrible storm, seeing the ruined church lit up, which you know is haunted anyway, and then do you go and have a look? Of course he does. And then what he sees is very intriguing, and you get drawn in, and the narrator of Tam O'Shanter is quite voyeuristic, so he's encouraging the readers also to be really interested in what's in the church. And what's in the church is quite horrific. It's presented in this comic way because the rhythm's so jaunty, but actually what he sees is old Nick playing his pipes and this dance of witches and warlocks with all the coffins standing open, so it is quite a horrific scene, and the idea that Tam is really just interested in the most attractive of the witches, who's wearing a dress that's too short for her, gets so excited that he cannot keep quiet, and he eventually shouts out famously, "Well done, Cutty Sark," which means "well done, very short dress," and in an instant all was dark.
Robert Crawford, it's often said that he's got a democratic voice. Is that true, and how could you illustrate it if it is true?
I think it is true. I think it comes, as I was saying earlier, from the way he talks to anybody in the same tone. The way he sings what he calls the royalty of man, that's in a poem addressed to George Washington. He seems to have been pretty sympathetic towards the American Revolution, and I think towards aspects of the French Revolution as well. We can call him a poet of a markedly democratic voice, but it's important to remember, first of all, he couldn't vote. Most people in his Ayrshire had no vote. And secondly, that the word democracy, especially in the 1790s, was a very dirty word in Britain. So Burns doesn't use the word democracy, I think, anywhere in his poetry. And yet what we hear repeatedly is this democratic tone of address and this celebration of what we would hear as a democratic voice.
Full of brothers be together and
yes.
friends will be together.
Man to man the world o'er shall brothers be for all that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
That sense
that's
of,
in a man's man. That's what poetry,
yes.
isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Burns, you can hear sometimes echoes of French revolutionary song in Burns, for
Are
instance.
They echoing him, or is he echoing them?
No, he's echoing them, I think.
Yeah. Murray Piddock, so let's continue this revolutionary strain. How much evidence is there for the fact for him being a revolutionary?
I think the evidence is not that strong. I think there's a clear evidence that he's sympathetic to the American Revolution, and that he uses, for example, in the Rights of Women, the ça ira from the French Revolutionary lexicon. He's a bit concerned that he'll be investigated for revolutionary inclinations in the 1792-3, and that's headed off at the pass. But there still isn't a lot. There really isn't a lot there, because he's also joined the Company of Archers in 1792, who he also writes, "Who shall not sing, God save the king, shall hang as high as the steeple." He does say, "Don't forget the people," but forgetting the people is, I think, in my view, hardly necessarily a full-scale democratic commitment. He does think about joining the army and fighting for George III in the Americas at times. So I think the key to Burns, the reason that he's appealed in that sense, moving from the revolutionary to the international sphere of Burns across the world, is because it's to be found in an early poem of his about his relationships to women, his feeling hurt but acts apert. They're easy prey for Rab Mosqueel. The feeling hurt is always acting apert. It's got a voice which can be listing and going for a sodger. It's got a voice which can be sympathetic to revolution or the rights of women. It's a voice that condemns slavery, and it's a man that considers going to work in a plantation in Jamaica. He's a slippery character.
Fiona Stafford, we mentioned earlier the impact of celebrity. He was a drinker anyway, but he really turned to alcohol here.
Yeah, I think he always enjoyed a drink. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And lots of his famous poems are about Scotch drink or whatever. But I think he did drink more and more, without a doubt. And I think that would be a way of interpreting that he was finding life actually rather unmanageable, partly because of his fame, partly because of all these babies we were talking about earlier. I think
and
he had
the debt.
Yes, and exactly.
His brother's debt that he was on his shoulders.
He's in financial difficulty as well. So he has a lot of pressure on him. And I think that was one of the contributing factors for him drinking.
Robert.
Two other things maybe to add to that would be that he seems to have had a depressive streak. He had a kind of breakdown when he was about 21. And although it's hard to diagnose this from a 21st century point of view, the word Burns uses of it is hypochondria. He doesn't mean by that imagining illnesses. He means closer, I think, to something that was called hypochondriasis in the 18th century, and was often connected both with stomach problems and with low spirits. And these kind of depressive episodes recur. In which case, the worst thing you can do is take more drink. But I think he's also under kinds of pressure at the end of his life, coming from the fact that he's a servant of the crown. He's working as an excise man by the 1790s. And yet the last long conversation with Burns to be written down describes him and a friend as staunch Republicans. So there seems to be a clash between perhaps some views, at least, that he expresses in private and that may come into some of his poems, and other poems where he's asserting apparently a fierce loyalty to the crown and is frightened, I think, about being taken to task for opinions that would not be appropriate to a civil servant.
He is playing the part, as you said, Murray. Is this going to be run a slave in camp, place?
Yes.
He's an excise man. He's a farmer in the fields, and so on.
He's not quite a chameleon poet, as Keats argued poets should be, but he's certainly often self-dramatising, and he will dramatise one mood, one position, and then another mood, another position. In the same way as, although we think of him as a great singer of male love songs, he also writes songs from a woman's perspective. You know, so he's an imaginative artist. He enters into various kinds of being, tonality and mood.
I think it's fair to say that in terms of his private views, you know, he makes slightly disagreeing emphasis, Robert, that he also is very pleased to say, "Tonight I dine with a lord," after having a dinner with Lord Dare. So he's very capable of expressing Republican sentiments to what might be sympathetic ears, but he's equally capable of sounding like rather a snob. So, so I think the question for Burns is, the man of independent mind is also a man who has got, who sets himself above the coward slave, and he's very, to quote from A Man's a Man for All That, and I think he's very well aware of that in himself.
Fiona?
Yes, so I was just going to go back to Murray's reading of the Heaven Taught Plowman, actually, and that comparison with Shakespeare, because that's partly what Mackenzie's putting his finger on, isn't it? That Burns does have this ability to adopt different voices and different roles. And I think one of the difficulties is that even when he's writing letters, which are obviously a major biographical source, he's adopting different voices depending on who he's writing to. So I think he's very aware of different audiences and of not necessarily being pinned down to a particular position.
Robert, we're coming towards the end now. Was his reputation, he woke up almost like wine to find himself famous. Did his reputation, was it lowered? He died when he was 37. Did it stay steady or did it grow? What's going on there?
It grows among not least the English Romantic poets, Keats, Wordsworth and others make pilgrimages to the Burns
country.
Wordsworth reads Burns when he Wordsworth is young. Mm. And Wordsworth's notion of writing in a selection of the language really used by men is very Burnsian, except Wordsworth seems to comb the dialect out of his poetry. You know, if only Wordsworth hadn't gone to Cambridge, he might still have written in Cumbrian dialect.
That would have been the thing, wouldn't it?
And
life
Burns,
would have been entirely
Burns,
different.
By the same chance, might have been ruined by going to university. We can't tell that.
Often happens.
But he certainly makes a big impact on the generation of poets after him. And he goes on making an impact, not least in America. Whitman is fascinated by Burns. Whitman, again, a poet who wants to have a kind of bardic voice. Doesn't sound like Burns, but recognises the bardic element in Burns.
So he's moved to America, Murray, and he's getting translated all over the world. And then he becomes very important in China, Russia, Germany, on it goes.
Yes, I mean, he's first translated before his death into German in 1795, though I don't think he was aware of that. The translation by Franz Frilligrave, A Man's a Man for All That, Trotz Alledem, becomes the key song of the 1848 revolution and, in a slightly altered form, remains a song of the German left from 1918 to the present day. So that song is almost as common on YouTube and other platforms as the original Man's a Man.
And in the Long March they sang.
Indeed.
Which was on the one they sang there?
My heart's in the Highlands. But both in China, he was used in the Cultural Revolution because he was the example of an intellectual who could stay on the land. And in Russia, he was used as an example by Stalin's translator Samuel Marshak of the good kulak, the kulak who didn't want to just amass wealth and money, but was happy for honest poverty and independence of mind.
Finally, Fiona, how did he knead into the growth of the Romantic poets and their movement? They went up to his cottage in numbers, and so they touched the grail, as it were.
They certainly did, and it was all the kind of famous Romantic poets we can think of were influenced by Burns, so Wordsworth and Coleridge, but also Dorothy Wordsworth was very taken with Burns. She was laughing about To Allow in 1787 straight away.
And Keats.
Keats went on a pilgrimage and he tried to write a poem in Burns's cottage and was very unhappy with his performance. So Burns had obviously produced a great anxiety of influence in Keats. But you find Jane Austen obviously very familiar with Burns, which is another thing that surprises people.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Fiona Stafford, Robert Crawford and Murray Pittock. All suggestions for our Listener Week by tomorrow, 25th of October, please. Next week it's hybrids, when two species cross and make a different entity as part of the constant motion of evolution. Thank you for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
I could say a wee bit more about his legacy to the present and to more recent poetry.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Do you want to say that? Please, the mic's open.
I think Burns has an astonishing range of afterlives. Shostakovich, during the siege of Leningrad, set one of Burns's most moving songs O Wert Thou in the Cold Blast. Burns has a huge range of afterlives in classical music, though he's associated rightly with folk music. But in modern poetry as well, he's a living force in the work of Seamus Heaney, who wrote a lot of verse letters in the Burns stanza, grew up listening to Burns, and I suppose as someone who identified with a farming community where a form of Scots was spoken, was drawn to Burns. But a rather different poet, Les Murray in Australia, also grew up listening to Burns, had a deep love of Burns. And if you think of Les Murray as in some ways an Australian bard, well, there are similarities between his stance and some of Burns' attitudes. Maya Angelou grew up having a very moving encounter with Burns's work, despite the fact, as we were saying earlier, that Burns nearly went to work on a slave plantation. Nonetheless, his was a voice that spoke to her, a voice of the people, a democratic voice. In contemporary Scottish poetry, in Kathleen Jamie, in Dawn Patterson, who has edited Burns' work, and in others, in Liz Lochhead, in Douglas Dunn, in W.N. Herbert, you will hear the Burns stanza, you will hear allusions to Burns. So there's a sense in which Burns has just never gone away.
Well, that's the most comprehensive answer to that question I've ever had. And thank goodness it's being recorded, and it'll whiz around the world for the next forever, really. Anything?
I was
terrific. Thank you. I was thinking of Don Patterson, actually. Right.
I was going to say. I'm very glad to raise that because of the impact in Beethoven, Haydn, Ravel, Mendelssohn, and down to Ervo Pärt is huge. And that's. But I wanted to mention the supper. The Burns supper.
Ah, the Burns supper.
Because the Burns supper is actually a unique event in terms of literary celebration. There are now about 9.5 million people attending registered Burns suppers worldwide.
Do they all pipe in the haggis?
They nearly all do, but not all of them are police. There's usually an inflection from local national culture into the supper. But because the poetry is always recited, because the songs are always sung, it's an enormously important part of dissemination. It is in some countries the only element of Scottish culture that people actually see is the Burns supper. And originally put together in 1801, it seems to have had a relationship to fox suppers. They were quite widespread there. Nelson suppers, which took off for a bit and then faded away. Fox suppers were the day before the 25th of January for the Whig politician Charles James Fox. And given what Robert said about Burns's democratic voice and reputation, the fact that fox suppers migrated into Burns suppers in the first quarter of the 19th century is quite interesting. But the fact is that today it's at an enormous scale with great PR, like the highest Burns supper in the world, which was done, but first of all, by BOAC at 11,000 metres in 1961, and then by the late Andrew Fairley on Kilimanjaro for the 250th anniversary of Burns' birth in 2009. So I am a devotee of the International Burns Supper.
So London is going to land up in space before we know.
Absolutely. The Burns in Orbit is the next stop.
Yeah, this needs to be counterbalanced by the lowest Burns supper.
Yeah. Well, I think I'd go back to the late 18th century, actually, on this point. Not about Burns supper so much, but actually talk a little bit about his importance for people who felt that their own regional dialect wasn't acceptable. I think Burns is hugely important in that way, and I think that's part of his appeal in Ireland. But someone like Robert Anderson, the Cumbrian poet, is really, really affected by Burns.
He's contemporary of Wordsworth, isn't he?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, Wordsworth subscribes to one of his collections. And yeah. I think the success of Burns, although in some ways some of the kind of reception was a little bit double-edged, just gives an enormous kind of boost. It says, OK, you don't need to speak standard English, you don't need to write standard English, in order to publish great poetry. And I think that's terribly important. And I think that had a kind of very inspiring effect, not just on the famous Romantic poets, but on lots and lots of others as well, and on women. Anyone who's kind of slightly out of the sort of the establishment is given a kind of, you know, free pass by Burns.
One second, but at the very beginning of the programme, he wanted both, didn't he, from the mouse He wanted his wee slicket, and then he wanted Enlightenment language to follow immediately. He wanted the both.
He always wanted that scale of audience. But actually, what Fiona says is directly and true in terms of his use by Czech language activists, in terms of his use to rehabilitate Swiss German, and also in his Henrik Wergeland's development of standard Norwegian in the early 19th century, that like many Romantic writers, he had a huge impact on Romantic nation building and articulations of the national self through language.
Yes, that apparently simple title of his first and in a sense his only book, Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect, is actually quite complicated. Chiefly in the Scottish dialect, meaning I'm going to use English sometimes too and whenever I like, but chiefly in the Scottish dialect carries a language politics with it at a time where people in Scotland, particularly people like me, university professors, were saying, write in proper standard English. Burns publishes Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect, and that championing of speak how you like, speak the way you were brought up to speak, is something that goes on resonating in Tony Harrison, in James Kelman, and in later writers.
That must have been bold of him at the time, then. He wants to make his name as a poet, and he starts off with the dialect, and it's mostly the dialect. And does he put the bits of Enlightenment English in just to say, I can do this as well if I want to?
No, I think he has access to that.
Well, no, no. I was going to say yes.
No, it's not just a kind of showing off. It's wanting to use the whole spectrum of the language to which he has access, to be fully a poet.
Mm. But you think he's doing it to show them he can do it if he wants to?
I think there's a strong element of that, because he's presenting himself as the simple bard, isn't he? But he's revealing. He's read Adam Smith, that he can write in that English if he wishes to.
But I think he establishes himself as a sophisticate by challenging the language that he utilises by the language that he grew up with. And that's the sweet spot where he demonstrates that he is actually intellectually capable in all these spheres. He uses just over 2,000 words of Scots and about 75 words of Gaelic too. But he has also a very large English vocabulary. It's very much up with and indeed beyond Milton's 8,000 words used.
Really?
So it's a very strikingly wide range of language use that he's got to cover all these voices, but within them all, to control and to establish his own superiority among and over the ideas of his own time as well as the feelings, and to be, as he is, so incredibly elusive as well as allusive and comprehensively accessible throughout the world.
In fact, what you said in the programme about him, when he was this if he wasn't a chameleon, he was nearly a chameleon. And if he wasn't a chameleon and like a chameleon, how would you describe it, Robert?
I think he dances through language. He's very, very articulate, and he was physically a great dancer, but he's astonishingly nimble the way he moves through language and the way he makes language dance. One of my favourite lines is the line from that describes the dancers in Tam O'Shanter. They crossed, they click it. Burns knows and understands dancing. He understands rhythm, and you can hear that throughout his poetry, whether it's sung or whether it's read.
Fiona, were you about to add to that?
No, I was only going to just say that obviously in order to be a poet you have to go to dancing classes first, which wasn't going to add anything to the greatest.
I think it added a lot. It's the most illuminating remark we've heard in the last 5 seconds.
So I apologise for that.
Well, that was a cracker. Thank you all very much. The producer can't wait to get in and make the offer of the week to you.
Not at all. So you want tea or coffee?
Yeah, tea? Yes, please. Tea's too lovely. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Three teas.
Simon, yeah. I love a coffee, please.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Hi, I'm Alistair Sook, and I want to tell you about The Way I See It, a brand new podcast from BBC Radio 3. It's a 30-part series in which we're throwing open the collection at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, to some of the sharpest creative minds of our time. We'll be speaking to comedian Steve Martin, writer Roxane Gay, musician Steve Reich, and many, many more. I'll be your guide throughout the series, so join me as I explore one of the greatest collections of modern art in the world. If you'd like to hear more, just search for The Way I See It on BBC Sounds.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.